so far in the colloquium, and that's the fact that the human body is an ecosystem. In the last 15 to 20 years, we've come to realize the importance of our microbial inhabitants. And we know now that there's about a 1-to-1 ratio of bacterial to human cells in the body. So by cell count, we're only 50% human. There's about a 150-to-1 ratio of unique bacterial to human genes. So with regard to gene content and metabolic capacity, we're actually quite in the minority. There are characteristic microbial communities at different body sites. Basically, every body site that is exposed at all to the environment contains a very unique microbial community. But by far, the largest communities and the most variable reside in the gut, which has about 10 to the 14th organisms. We know now that our gut microbiome has co-evolved with us. If we have a look at the phylogeny of the hominids, we can see that divergence times between hosts shows more or less a linear pattern with microbiome dissimilarity between different hosts. And actually, humans have accelerated in our microbiome evolution recently, which is likely an influence of culture and things like antibiotic use. We also know that we have adapted in response to our microbiomes, and probably the best example of this are human milk oligosaccharides. And these are sugars that are present in breast milk, and they are totally indigestible by infants. They appear to be placed there for the benefit of culturing particular microbes that help train the infant immune system and can confer protection against pathogen exposure. And you can appreciate why this might be important, because as we've heard yesterday, lactation is the most energetically costly period of a woman's life. And for natural selection to have favored the synthesis and secretion of these materials in breast milk by a mother who is energetically stressed, there must be a dramatic energetic return to the infant at some point that enhances a mother's reproductive success. We now know also that the gut microbiome plays a huge range of physiological roles. These range from direct impacts on energy acquisition through the metabolism of food nutrients and the biosynthesis of vitamins and amino acids, as well as the promotion of fat storage in adipocytes, to functions that affect energy expenditure, such as the maintenance of the epithelial barrier, which helps protect against systemic inflammation, the development and the training of the immune system, resistance against pathogens, as well as a variety of other metabolic functions that have to do with nutrient partitioning. So today what I would like to do is to consider the hypothesis that the gut microbiome can serve as an energetic buffer against fluctuations in diet. And I'll sort of explore this hypothesis in three ways. First, by considering that the gut microbiome contributes critically to energy acquisition. Second, by considering that it responds rapidly to changes in diet. And finally, by presenting a case study that shows that less digestible diets favor higher energy return by microbes. Now, we've known actually now for going on a century that microbes participate in energy acquisition. And the classic model looks a bit like this. This is the small intestine and the colon. And these are nutrients, fats, carbohydrates, and proteins that are coming in from the stomach. And we, of course, digest fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. And so a lot of these materials disappear in the small intestine. But some fraction of carbohydrates and protein are in fact not absorbed by us, and they pass into the colon, where we lose our ability to absorb these nutrients directly, and they are instead fermented by the gut microbiome, producing short-chain fatty acids. And these short-chain fatty acids, for example, acetate, butyrate, or propionate from the metabolism of carbohydrate, can be absorbed by us and utilized for energy gain. But what we didn't really realize until, say, the last 15 years or so was the extent to which these microbial contributions are affecting energy acquisition. And we know this by studying germ-free mice, who we can then give a microbiome, turning them into conventional mice, more or less, and we can observe what happens to the host after they're given a microbial community. And what happens is that The conventionalized animals who now have a microbial community gain 60% more body fat in the course of 2 weeks, and this is despite eating less chow, so less of the same food, and expending greater overall energy. We also now know that different microbiomes differ in their contributions to energy gain. So it's not just the fact of whether you've got one or not. We all have microbiomes. But different microbiomes will affect this process to different extents. And we know this by studies of, for example, lean or obese individuals who show differences in the profile of their microbiome. Here, obese individuals have more of one type of phyla and less of another. And it's not just that there's an association between obesity and a different microbial profile. It's in fact that the microbial profile is contributing to obesity. And we know this because we can take these microbial communities out and put them into germ-free animals and again observe what happens to the recipient. And what we see is that recipients of a microbiome, as I've shown you before, whether they received a donation from a lean donor or from an obese donor, they do actually show an increase in body fat. But if they received a donation from an obese donor, they gained 75% more body fat, despite no differences in food intake or energy expenditure. And it's not just in mice. We now have evidence from humans that the human microbiome directly contributes to a range of metabolic phenotypes, including obesity, type 2 diabetes, systemic low-grade inflammation, atherosclerosis, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and generally we've moved beyond associations where you say take two individuals who differ, for example, in obesity and show that they have different microbiomes. We've actually done the transplant experiments to show that you can confer the phenotype to a mouse purely by transferring the gut microbiome. So it's quite clear that the gut microbiome is both important for energy acquisition and variable in its contributions to energy acquisition. Some of the mechanisms that control this process have to do with energy salvage from indigestible nutrients, as I've shown you before. We know that microbes regulate bile acid synthesis, and this is important for the emulsification of fats and the digestion of fats within the small intestine. We know that the microbiome matures and regulates immune function, which obviously is relevant for energy expenditure. And we know that the microbiomes can directly control the degree to which fat is stored in adipocytes versus metabolized. So as I mentioned, the gut microbiome, I think, is both critical for energy acquisition and variable in its contributions. Next, I'll talk about the role of the gut microbiome in regard to diet. Now, it makes sense when we just think about the gut that microbes should be sensitive to diet. They live within the gastrointestinal tract, and the main nutrient flows that go through their ecosystem come from diet. It's as in any ecosystem where you change nutrient flows, you create new niches, and this selects for particular communities. And we know that that microbiomes are sensitive to diet in a variety of ways. One, there have been analyses looking across different host taxa, mammalian taxa, showing that carnivores, shown here in red, herbivores, shown here in green, and omnivores, shown here in blue, have microbiomes that cluster together based on the feeding pattern of the host. There have been experiments taking human gut microbes and placing them in defined communities. So you can take 10 of the most common microbes and you combine them in equal proportions and you put that community into a mouse. And then you can actually do models looking at the fraction of the diet coming in from casein, which is protein, starch, sucrose, which is sugar, or oil. And you find you can predict about 60% of the resulting microbial community purely on the basis of knowing what macronutrients went in. And finally, we have evidence in humans, here from the Hadza, showing that there's substantial seasonal variation in the microbiome that seems to be driven by differences in feeding pattern. But what we didn't appreciate very well was how flexible these responses really are. I conducted an experiment a couple of years ago where I took mice and I oscillated them between high-fat, high-sugar diets and low-fat, high-fiber diets, 3 days on one, 3 days on another. So essentially, this was a yo-yo diet for a mouse. And I had two groups, one that started off with the high-fat diet and the other that started off with the low-fat diet. And here's what I saw. What you're looking at is an index of the microbial community profile. And you can see this incredible oscillating pattern where my pointer is dying here, but where when mice were fed the high-fat diet, they had one kind of profile in each of the 3 days they were fed the diet, and that switched to the low-fat profile and to the high-fat profile and to the low-fat profile in this beautiful oscillating pattern. The other thing we realize from this is that it takes less than 1 day for the microbial community to completely turn over and to reflect the new diet that has flowed through the system. The second oscillating group showed the exact same pattern, just with a phase shift. And our control groups that were never oscillated did not show this pattern. So this was obviously very specific to the diets that were being fed and the pattern in which the diets were being fed. We've also done an experiment with humans where we fed human volunteers either an all plant-based diet or an all animal-based diet, and we saw what happened with the microbiome. In this case, I'm just going to show you what happened with the 100% animal-based diet, where we took some samples at baseline. We fed these diets for a period of 5 days, and then there was a washout period. And what we observed is that within 24 hours of feeding an animal-based diet, we saw dramatic changes in the microbial community that were similar across all the participants in the experiment. And specifically, what we saw is a reduction in saccharolytic bacteria. So these are bacteria that specialize in the breakdown of carbohydrates. And we saw an increase in bile-tolerant organisms. So these are organisms that we expect to be enriched on a high-fat diet, because with more fat, you produce more bile in order to emulsify and digest that fat. Interestingly, what we also observed was this incredible shift in what the microbes were doing within the gut, again within 24 hours of seeing this diet. I'm just showing you one example for amino acid metabolism. On an animal-based diet, you expect there to be more amino acid catabolism because there's more protein coming in compared to a plant-based diet. And on a plant-based diet, you expect there to be more synthesis. And what we observed was the microbial patterns of transcription showed enrichments along the entire pathway toward catabolism or synthesis that was based on the diet. So on a plant-based diet, we saw all the steps of the process that lead to synthesis. On an animal-based diet, we saw all of the steps of the process that lead to catabolism. And this is identical to what has been observed in carnivores versus herbivores. In fact, the patterns of microbial transcription matched perfectly against a prior data set that had looked at these patterns in carnivores and herbivores. So in other words, the gut microbiome, within a single day, can change its transcriptional pattern to look like a carnivore or herbivore, depending on what was recently eaten by humans. So obviously, it responds rapidly and reproducibly to diet. And next, I'd like to consider a case study that I'm currently running. This is not published data yet, that evaluates the impact of digestibility. And so for the same reason that we expect diets to impact the microbiome by affecting nutrient flows, we expect the digestibility of those diets to impact the gut microbiome by changing the fraction of nutrients that make it through the small intestine and into the colon, right? So if more gets absorbed here, less enters here, and this is changing the ecology of the microbes themselves. So again, the key concepts here are that nutrients reaching the colon should select for microbes that are capable of the metabolism of those nutrients. And secondly, that this enhanced microbial metabolism should actually increase the fraction of the undigested materials that get returned to the host in the form of short-chain fatty acids. So we wanted to test these ideas. And the way that I thought to do this was by taking a model hominin fallback food, a type of tuber. Now, obviously, these are not the same kinds of tubers that ancestral hominins would be eating. This was a sweet potato, but this is what I had available to me. And I chose this for a second reason, which is that some of my prior research had shown that raw versus cooked sweet potato showed profound differences in energy gain by the host. And so if we fed mice raw versus pounded versus cooked, or cooked and pounded sweet potato, mice that were given sweet potato in any raw form lost weight, whereas mice that were given sweet potato in any cooked form maintained body weight. And this was driven by patterns of starch digestibility. We talked a little bit about this yesterday. At least in our food, we see that when the starch in the sweet potato is cooked, it undergoes a process known as gelatinization, which allows amylase, the primary enzyme that digests starch, to come in and cleave off the mono and disaccharides that we can make use of within our bodies. And so this process of starch gelatinization makes the starch more digestible when it's cooked, less digestible when it's raw, and this is contributing to differences in energy gain. So we use this as a model to test how digestibility is affecting the microbiome and how those changes in the microbiome feed back into host energy gain. And to do this, I fed mice diets of raw sweet potato, cooked sweet potato, or cooked sweet potato in a restricted ration. And the point of that was to control for the weight loss that we experienced, that these mice experience on a raw diet versus a cooked. So this was a weight loss controlled study. We collected samples at baseline and for 5 days during feeding. And we used fecal samples for an analysis of microbial community composition. And we used cecal contents for an analysis of microbial community transcription. So again, what the microbes were doing. And what we initially saw with regard to composition was this. This is a principal coordinate plot. It's basically a way of summarizing the composition of the microbial community. So each dot represents a sample. And what you can see are the samples collected from mice fed raw, cluster over here, and the samples from mice fed cooked, cluster over here. And there's not a lot of difference between whether the mice were fed cooked in a free-fed ration or a restricted ration. This really wasn't a story about weight loss. This was a story about whether the diet was cooked or not. This was a significant clustering of these microbial communities, suggesting that cooking had a profound impact on community composition. And the same was true on a transcription level. So when we look at what the microbes were doing, we see perfect separation between transcriptional patterns for mice, for the microbial communities of mice that were fed the raw sweet potato versus those that were fed the cooked sweet potato. And importantly, on the raw diet, we saw higher beta amylase activity within the microbiome. And this is what you would expect if microbes on the raw diet were digesting starch. So in other words, the starch that was not absorbed because it was less digestible by us, made it into the colon. Now these microbes were doing their job. We then designed diets that were chow-based. So if you imagine a little mouse chow, and all we did was to create two chows that were identical. They either had high digestibility starch or they had low digestibility starch. So this was another tightly controlled way of evaluating whether these effects were due to differences in starch digestibility. And again, what we saw is that on the high starch digestibility diets, the microbiomes clustered here. On the low digestibility starch diets, they clustered here. And again, we see separation that starts within a single day, as indicated by these points that have the open circles, which were collected from the first 24 hours. We saw patterns both with regard to the diversity of the microbial community, as well as key patterns that at a high level look at the proportion between different microbial phyla in the microbiome. And these patterns largely matched up to what we had seen on our diet that was based on sweet potato. So we could actually recapitulate changes in the microbial community that we saw on the sweet potato diet purely by manipulating the digestibility of the starch fraction. Finally, what we did was to ask, well, okay, so we know that the microbial community changes depending on whether you're eating raw versus cooked tuber. Does that matter for host energy gain? So what we did was to take mice and we fed them either a raw sweet potato diet or a cooked sweet potato diet, and these donor mice provided microbiomes that we then transplanted into germ-free animals, and we transplanted them either so the microbes were still alive, or we autoclaved it so that the microbes then were dead, but everything else about that inoculum was the same. And we fed the recipient animals chow for a period of 2 weeks in order to explore whether differences in the conditioning of the microbiome affected the recipient energy gain. And we found that it did. And specifically with regard to body mass, which is what you see up here, or with regard to body fat, which is what you see down here, you can see that getting a live microbial community compared to getting a dead microbial community increased body mass and increased body fat. But if the microbial community had been conditioned on a raw diet, the recipient gained more weight and gained more body fat than if they had received a microbiome that had been conditioned on a cooked diet. So the model that's really emerging here for a low digestibility food like raw sweet potato is that there's less energy gained directly by the host, and this leads to more nutrients making it into the colon to become available for microbial fermentation. This leads to an altered gut microbial structure and function, and more indigestible energy is returned to the host through the actions of the microbiome. So if we just kind of focus on the net effects here, we've got a situation where you've got less energy that's gained directly by the host, and this has led to microbial community changes that return a greater fraction of the energy that they see back to the host. And this creates a situation where the gut microbiome can buffer against energy shortfalls. And this may have actually been very important in human evolution and in modern human societies that undergo significant dietary volatility, both over the course of seasons, but importantly, over the course of day-to-day stochastic variation in whether or not you were successful in a hunt or, you know, what particular makeup of foods were coming in from a particular foraging effort. So again, with regard to the hypothesis that the gut microbiome may serve as an energy buffer against fluctuations in diet, I hope I've shown you that the gut microbiome contributes critically to energy acquisition, it's very sensitive to diet on a very short-term basis, and that less digestible diets, in fact, favor higher energy return by the microbiome. So I think if we take a step back, and we start really trying to incorporate the gut microbiome into our understanding of hominin energy budgets, we can view the microbiome as this sort of extra genomic resource of metabolic capabilities. And not only does it contribute importantly to our overall energy gain, it confers a degree of digestive flexibility that I think we don't typically think about. We tend to think of human abilities and the change in human abilities over the courses of generations, hundreds of years, thousands of years. But here we're seeing that the digestive capacities are changing within the span of 24 hours. And I think that adaptability is especially intriguing when we think about what ancestral humans were capable of with regard to foraging. And incorporating a microbial perspective also allows us to raise some really intriguing new questions. Have humans farmed our gut microbiome unconsciously over the past in order to maximize energy gain? I have some research looking at polyphenol intake, and of course in modern agriculture, we've done everything we can to select polyphenols out because they produce a bitter taste. But these polyphenols actually play a very important role in modulating gut microbial contributions to energy gain. So it's intriguing to think about whether we've, you know, some of the activities that we've done to select out certain nutrients have in fact affected our energy gains over evolutionary time. We can ask, under what conditions are these interactions complementary versus competitive? I've shown you a lot of microbes in the colon, but microbes actually live in the small intestine as well. And that's where we might expect there to be more competitive interactions, because this is where we get first dibs at the food. And we have done a lot, not consciously, but over evolutionary time, to exclude microbes from the small intestine so that we retain our first access to those nutrients. We could ask, does the human gut microbiome harbor unique digestive functions, or have we lost particular digestive functions that reflect our dietary ecology? For example, we talked yesterday about the formation of Maillard reaction products or heterocyclic amines that come in with the charring of meat. Of course, cooking is unique to humans. We might expect that these compounds, which we know humans don't metabolize, we know the gut microbiome metabolizes Maillard reaction products and heterocyclic amines, we might ask, does the human microbiome do that better than, say, other great apes, the microbiomes of other great apes, because of our evolutionary history of cooking? And finally, since we know that the microbiome has affected the human phenotype, I've shown you a lot of data so far showing that with regard to energy gain, and we know that natural selection acts on the human phenotype, that raises the possibility that a lot of signatures of selection on humans are not embedded within the human genome, which again is 1 to 150, the ratio of the number of unique genes in the microbial metagenome. It raises the possibility that some signatures of human selection are in fact embedded in the microbial metagenome instead. And so I think we can start to expand our search for signatures of selection on humans by considering coevolutionary signatures within the human and microbial metagenomes. And with that, I'd just like to acknowledge some of the collaborators who've contributed to some of the unpublished work that I've shown here, as well as my lab and others for research support, and I'm happy to take your questions.